forth from one to the other. So, this was what it must have been like to be M in the James Bond movies. Being the boss had its moments, but it had its stresses, too. Sure, he had that undated presidential pardon in a safety deposit box, but that didn't mean he ever wanted to make use of it. That would make him even more of a pariah than he already was, and the newsies would never leave him alone to his dying day. Not exactly his idea of fun. Just so they don't pretend to be room service and whack him in the hotel room, Jerry thought aloud. Hey, if they were that dumb, they'd already be in some German prison, Granger pointed out. The crossover into Italy was no more formal than crossing over from Tennessee into Virginia, which was one benefit of the European Union. The first Italian city was Velaco, where the people looked a lot more German than Sicilian to their fellow Italians, and from there southwest on the A23. They still needed to learn a little about interchanges, Dominic thought, but these roads were definitely better than they'd run for the famous Mille Miglia, the 1,000-mile sports car race of the 1950s, canceled because too many people got killed watching it from the side of the country roads. The land here was not distinguishable from Austria, and the farm buildings were much the same as well. All in all, it was pretty country, not unlike Tennessee or western Virginia, with rolling hills and cows that probably got milked twice a day to feed children on both sides of the border. Next came Udine, then Mestre, and they changed highways again for the A4 to Padova, switched over to A13, and an hour more to Bologna. The Apennine Mountains were to their left, and the marine part of Brian looked at the hills and shuddered at the battlefield they represented. But then his stomach started growling again. You know, Enzo, every town we pass has at least one great restaurant. Great pasta, homemade cheese, vitella francese, the wine cellar from hell. I'm hungry too, Brian. And yeah, we're surrounded by Italian soul food. Unfortunately, we have a mission. I just hope the son of a bitch is worth what we're missing, man. Ours is not to reason why, bro, Dominic offered. Yeah, but you can stick the other half of that sentence up your ass. Dominic started laughing. He didn't like it either. The food in Munich and Vienna had been excellent, but all around them was the place where good food had been invented. Napoleon himself had traveled with an Italian chef on his campaigns, and most of modern French cuisine had evolved directly from that one man, as racehorses were all lineal descendants of an Arabian stallion named Eclipse. And he didn't even know the man's name. Pity, he thought, passing a tractor trailer, whose driver probably knew the best local places. Shit. They drove with their lights on, a rule in Italy, enforced by the Polizia Stradale, who were not renowned for their leniency, at a steady 150 kilometers per hour, just over 90 miles to the hour, and the Porsche seemed to love it. Gas mileage was over 25, or so Dominic guessed. The arithmetic of kilometers and liters against miles and gallons was too much for him while concentrating on the road. At Bologna, they joined up with the A1 and continued south toward Firenze, the city of origin for the Caruso family. The road cut through the mountains going southwest and was beautifully engineered. Bypassing Florence was very hard. Brian knew of a fine restaurant near the Ponte Vecchio that belonged to distant cousins where the wine was bellissima and the food worthy of a king. But Rome was only 2 more hours away. He remembered going there by train that one time in his undress greens with the Sam Brown belt to proclaim his professional identity. And sure enough, the Italians had liked the United States Marines, like all civilized people. He'd hated taking the train back to Rome and thence to Naples and his ship, but his time had not been his own, as it wasn't now. There were more mountains as they headed south, but now some of the signs proclaimed Roma, and that was good. Jack ate in the Excelsior's dining room, and the food was everything he'd expected. and the staff treated him like a prodigal member of the family come home after a protracted absence. His only complaint was that nearly everyone here was smoking. Well, perhaps Italy didn't know about secondhand smoke dangers. He'd grown up hearing all about it from his mother, who'd often aimed the remarks at Dad, who was always struggling to quit the habit once and for all, and never quite made it. He took his time with dinner. Only the salad was ordinary. Even the Italians couldn't change lettuce, though the dressings were brilliant. He'd taken a corner table to be able to survey the room. The other diners looked as ordinary as he did. All were well-dressed. The guest services book in his room didn't say a tie was required, but he'd just assumed it. And besides, Italy was the world headquarters of style. He hoped to get a suit while here, if time permitted. There were 30 or 40 people here. Jack discounted the ones with wives handy. So, he was looking for someone about 30 years old, eating dinner alone, registered as Nigel Hawkins. He ended up with 3 possibilities. He decided to look for people who didn't look Arabic in their ethnicity, and that weeded one out. So, what to do now? Was he supposed to do anything at all? How could it hurt, unless he identified himself as an intelligence officer? But why take chances? He asked himself. Why not just be cool? And with that thought, he backed off, mentally at least. Better to ID the guy another way. Rome was indeed a fine city, Mohammed Hassan al-Din told himself. He periodically thought about renting an apartment or even a house. You could even rent one in the Jewish quarter. There were some fine kosher restaurants in that part of the city, where one could order anything on the menu with confidence. He'd looked once at an apartment on the Piazza Campo di Fiori, but while the price, even the tourist price, had not been unreasonable, the idea of being tied down to a single location had frightened him off. Better to be mobile in his business. The enemies couldn't strike at that which they could not find. He'd taken chance enough killing the Jew Greengold. He'd been tongue-lashed by the emir himself for that bit of personal amusement, and told never to do anything like it ever again. What if the Mossad had gotten a picture of him? How valuable would he be to the organization then, the emir had demanded angrily. And that man was known by his colleagues for his volcanic temper. So, no more of that. He didn't even carry the knife with him, but kept it in a place of honor in his shaving kit, where he could take it out and inspect the Jew blood on the folding blade. So, for now, in Rome, he lived here. Next time, after he went back home, he'd return and stay at another. Maybe that nice one by the Trevi Fountain, he thought, though this location suited his activities better. And the food. Well, Italian food was richly excellent, better in his estimation than the simple fare of his home country. Lamb was good, but not every day. And here people didn't look at you like an infidel if you had a small sip of wine. He wondered if Mohammed, his own eponym, had knowingly allowed the faithful to drink spirits made from honey, or simply hadn't known that mead existed. He'd tried it while at Cambridge University, and concluded that only someone who desperately needed to be drunk would ever sample it, much less spend a night with it. So, Mohammed was not quite perfect, and neither was he, the terrorist reminded himself. He did hard things for the faith, and so he was allowed to take a few diversions from the true path. If one had to live with rats, better to have a few whiskers after all. The waiter came to take away his dishes, and he decided to pass on dessert. He had to maintain his trim figure if he was to maintain his cover as an English businessman and fit into his Brioni suits. So he left the table and walked out to the elevator lobby. Ryan thought about a nightcap at the bar, but on reflection decided against it and walked out. There was somebody there already, and he got in the elevator first. There was a casual meeting of the eyes as Ryan moved to punch the 3 button, but saw it already lighted. So this well-dressed Brit, he looked like a Brit, was on his floor. Wasn't that interesting? It took only a few seconds for the car to stop and the door to open. The Excelsior is not a tall hotel, but it is an expansive one, and it was a lengthy walk. And the elevator man was heading in the right direction. Ryan slowed his pace to follow from a greater distance, and sure enough, he passed Jack's room and kept going. 1, 2, and at the 3rd door he stopped and turned. Then he looked back at Ryan, wondering perhaps if he was being tailed. But Jack stopped and fished out his own key. Then, looking down at the other man, in the casual, stranger-to-stranger voice that all men know, said, "Good night." "And to you, sir," was the reply in well-educated English. Jack walked into the room, thinking he'd heard that accent before, like the Brit diplomats whom he'd met in the White House or on trips to London with his dad. It was either the speech of someone to the manor born or who planned to buy his own when the time came and who'd banked enough pounds sterling to pretend to be a peer of the realm. He had the peaches and cream skin of a Brit, and the upper-class accent, and he was checked in under the name of Nigel Hawkins. "And I got one of your emails, pal," Jack whispered to the rug. "Son of a bitch." It took almost an hour to navigate through the streets of Rome, whose city fathers may not have been married to the city mothers, and none of whom had known shit about city planning, Brian thought, working to find a way to the Via Vittorio Veneto. Eventually he knew they were close when he passed through what may once have been a gate in the city walls designed to keep Hannibal Barca out. But then a left and a right, and they learned that in Rome streets with the same name do not always go straight, which necessitated a circle on the Palazzo Margherita to return back to the Hotel Excelsior, where Dominic decided he'd had quite enough driving for the next few days. Within 3 minutes, their bags were out of the trunk, and they were at the reception desk. "You have a message to call Signor Ryan when you get in. Your rooms are just next to his," the clerk told them. Then he waved at the bellman, who guided them to the elevator. "Long drive, man," Brian said, leaning back against the paneled walls. "Tell me about it," Dominic agreed. "I mean, I know you like fast cars and fast women, but next time, how about a damned airliner? Maybe you can score with a stew, you know?" "You friggin' jarhead," followed by a yawn. "This way, signori," the bellman suggested, with a wave of his arm. "The message at the desk, where is he?" "Signor Ryan, he is right here," the bellman pointed. "That's convenient," Dominic thought aloud, until he remembered something else. He let himself get moved in, and the connecting door to Brian's room opened, and he gave the bellman a generous tip. Then he took the message slip out of his pocket and called. "Hello? We're right next door, Ace. What's shaking?" Brian asked. "2 rooms? Roger that. Guess who's just down from you? Tell me." "A British guy, a Mr. Nigel Hawkins," Jack told his cousin, and waited for the shock to subside. "Let's talk." "Come right on over, Junior." That took no more time than Jack needed to slip into his loafers. "Enjoy the drive?" Jack asked. Dominic had poured his minibar wine into a glass. There wasn't much left. It was long. "You did all the driving?" "Hey, I wanted to get her alive, man." "You turkey," Brian snarled. "He thinks driving a Porsche is like sex, except better." "It is if you have the right technique, but even sex can wear a man out, okay?" Dominic set his glass down. "Did you say—" "Yeah, right there," Jack pointed at the wall, and moved his hand to his eyes. "I've seen the mutt." The reply was just nods. "Well, you guys get some sleep. I'll call you tomorrow, and we can think about our appointment. Cool? Very cool, Brian agreed. Ring us up about 9, okay? You bet. Later. And Jack headed for the door. Soon thereafter, he was back on his computer, and then it hit him. He wasn't the only guy here with one of those, was he? That might be valuable. 8 o'clock came earlier than it should have. Mohammed was up, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and on his machine checking his email. Mahmoud was in Rome as well, having arrived the previous night, and near the top of 56 Moha's mailbox was a letter from Gadfly 097 requesting a meeting site. Mohammed thought about that, and then decided to exercise his sense of humor. Ristorante Giovanni, Piazza di Spagna, he replied. 13:30. Be careful in your routine. By which he meant to employ counter-surveillance measures. There was no definite reason to suspect foul play in the loss of 3 field personnel, but he hadn't lived to the age of 31 in the business of intelligence by being foolish. He had the ability to tell the harmless from the dangerous, he thought. He'd gotten David Greengold 6 weeks earlier because the Jew hadn't seen the false flag play, even when it bit him on the ass. Well, the back of the neck, Mohammed thought with a lowercase smile, remembering the moment. Maybe he should start carrying the knife again, just for good luck. Many men in his line of work believed in luck, as a sportsman or athlete might. Perhaps the emir had been right. Killing the Mossad officer had been a gratuitously unnecessary risk, since it courted enemies. The organization had enough of those, even if the enemies did not know who and what the organization was. Better that they should be a mere shadow to the infidels, a shadow in a darkened room, unseen and unknown. Mossad was hated by his colleagues, but it was hated because it was feared. The Jews were formidable. They were vicious, and they were endlessly clever. And who could say what knowledge they had, what Arab traders bought with American money for Jewish ends? There was not a hint of treachery in the organization, but he remembered the words of the Russian KGB officer Yuri, "Treason is only possible from those whom you trust." It had probably been a mistake to kill the Russian so quickly. He'd been an experienced field officer who'd operated most of his career in Europe and America, and there'd probably been no end to the stories he could have told, each of them with a lesson to be learned. Mohammed remembered talking to him and remembered being impressed with the breadth of his experience and judgment. Instinct was nice to have, but instinct often merely mimicked mental illness in its rampant paranoia. Yuri had explained in considerable detail how to judge people and how to tell a professional from a harmless civilian. He could have told many more stories except for the 9mm bullet he'd gotten in the back of the head. It had also violated the Prophet's strict and admirable rules of hospitality. If a man eats your salt, even though he be an infidel, he will have the safety of your house. Well, the emir was the one who'd violated that rule, saying lamely that he'd been an atheist and therefore beyond the law. But he'd learned a few lessons anyway. All his emails were encrypted on the best such program there was, individually keyed to his own computer and therefore beyond anyone's capacity to read except himself. So, his communications were secure. He hardly looked Arab. He didn't sound Arabic. He didn't dress Arabic. Every hotel he stayed at knew that he drank alcohol, and such places knew that Muslims did not drink. So he ought to be completely safe. Well, yes, the Mossad knew that someone like him had killed that Greengold pig, but he didn't think they'd ever gotten a photo of him, and unless he'd been betrayed by the man whom he'd hired to fool the Jew, they had no idea of who and what he was. Yuri had warned him that you could never know everything, but also that being overly paranoid could alert a casual tale as to what he was, because professional intelligence officers knew tricks that no one else would ever use, and they could be seen to use them from careful observation. It was all like a big wheel, always turning, always coming back to the same place and moving on in the same way, never still, but never moving off its primary path. A great wheel. And he was just a cog. And whether his function was to help it move or make it slow down, he didn't really know. Ah, he shook that off. He was more than a cog. He was one of the motors. Not a great motor, perhaps, but an important one, because while the great wheel might move on without him, it would never move so quickly and surely as it did now. And, God willing, he would keep it moving until it crushed his enemies, the Emir's enemies, and Allah's own enemies. So, he dispatched his message to Gadfly 097 and called for coffee to be delivered. Rick Bell had arranged for a crew to be on the computers around the clock. Strange that the campus hadn't been doing that from the beginning, but now it did. The campus was learning as it went, just as everyone else did, on both sides of the scrimmage line. At the moment it was Tony Wills, driven by his personal appreciation that there was a 6-hour time difference between Central Europe and the American East Coast. A good computer jockey, he downloaded the message from 56 to 097 within 5 minutes of its dispatch and immediately forwarded it to Jack. That required fewer seconds than it took to think it. Okay, they knew their subject and they knew where he was going to be, and that was just fine. Jack lifted his phone. "You up?" Brian heard. "I am now," he growled back. "What is it?" "Come on over for coffee. Bring Dom with you."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Followed by click.
"I hope this is good," Dominic said. His eyes looked like piss holes in the snow.
"If you want to soar with the eagles in the morning, buddy, you can't wallow with the pigs at night.
Be cool. I ordered coffee."
"Thanks. So, what's up?" Jack walked over to his computer and pointed to the screen. They both leaned down to read.
"Who is this guy?" Dominic asked, thinking Gadfly 097?
"He came in from Vienna yesterday, too."
"Across the street somewhere, maybe?" Brian wondered, followed by, "Did he see my face?"
"Okay, I guess we're up for the appointment," Brian said, looking at Dom and getting a thumbs up. The coffee arrived in a few more minutes. Jack served, but the brew they all found was gritty, Turkish in character, though far worse even than the Turk served. Still, better than no coffee at all. They did not speak on point. Their tradecraft was good enough that they didn't talk business in a room that hadn't been swept for bugs, which they didn't know how to do, and for which they did not have the proper equipment. Jack gunned down his coffee and headed into the shower. In it was a red chain, evidently to be pulled in case of a heart attack, but he felt reasonably decent and didn't use it. He wasn't so sure about Dominic, who really did look like cat puke on the rug. In his case, the shower worked wonders, and he came back out shaved and scrubbed pink, ready to rumble. "The food here is pretty good, but I'm not sure about the coffee," he announced.
"Not sure. Jesus, I bet they serve better coffee in Cuba," Brian said.
"MRE coffee is better than this."
"Nobody's perfect, Aldo," Dominic observed, but he didn't like it either.
"So, figure half an hour?" Jack asked. He needed about 3 more minutes to be ready.
"If not, send an ambulance," Enzo said, heading for the door, and hoping the shower gods were merciful this morning. It was hardly fair, he thought.
Drinking gave you a hangover, not driving. But 30 minutes later, all three were in the lobby, neatly dressed and wearing sunglasses against the bright Italian sun that sparkled outside. Dominic asked the doorman for directions and got pointed to the Via Sistina, which led directly to the Trinità dei Monti Church, and the steps were just across the street, and looked to be 80 or so feet down. There was an elevator serving the subway stop, which was farther down still, but going downhill was not too outrageous a task. It hit all three that Rome had churches the way New York City had candy stores. The walk down was pleasant. The scene, indeed, would be wonderfully romantic if you had the right girl on your arm. The steps had been designed to follow the slope of the hill by the architect Francesco De Santis, and was the home of the annual Donna Sotto le Stelle fashion extravaganza. At the bottom was a fountain in which lay a marble boat commemorating a major flood, something in which a stone boat would be of little use. The piazza was the intersection of only two streets, and was named for the presence of the Spanish embassy to the Holy See. The playing field, as it were, was not very large, smaller than Times Square, for example, but it bustled with activity and vehicle traffic, and enough pedestrians to make passage there a dicey proposition for all involved. Ristorante Giovanni sat on the western side, an undistinguished building of yellow cream-painted brick, with a large canopied eating area outside. Inside was a bar at which everyone had a lighted cigarette. This included a police officer having a cup of coffee. Dominic and Brian walked in and looked around, scoping the area out before coming back outside. "We have 3 hours, people," Brian observed. "Now what?" "We want to be back here when?" Jack asked. Dominic checked his watch. "Our friend is supposed to show up at about 1:30. Figure we sit down for lunch about 12:45 and await developments." "Jack, can you ID the guy by sight?" "No problem," Junior assured them. "Then I guess we have about 2 hours to wander around. I was here a couple of years ago. There's good shopping." "Is that a Brioni store over there?" Jack asked, pointing.
"Looks like it," Brian answered.
"Won't hurt our cover to do some shopping."
"Then let's do it."
He'd never gotten an Italian suit. He had several English ones from No. 10 Savile Row in London. Why not try here? This spook business was crazy, he reflected. They were here to kill a terrorist. But beforehand, they'd do some clothes shopping. Even women wouldn't do that. Except maybe for shoes. In fact, there were all manner of stores to be seen on the Via del Babuino, Baboon Street of all things, and Jack took the time to look in many of them. Italy was indeed the world capital of style, and he tried on a light gray silk jacket that seemed to have been custom-made for him by a master tailor, and he purchased it on the spot for 800 euros. Then he had to carry the plastic bag over his shoulder. But was this not beautiful cover? What secret agent man would hobble himself with such an unlikely burden? Mohammed Hassan left the hotel at 12:15, taking the same walking route that the twins had done 2 hours earlier. He knew it well. He'd walked the same path on his way for Greengold's killing, and the thought comforted him. It was a fine, sunny day, the temperature reaching to about 30 degrees Celsius, a warm day, but not really a hot one. A good day for American tourists, Christian ones. American Jews went to Israel so that they could spit on Arabs. Here they were just Christian infidels looking to take photographs and buy clothes. Well, he'd bought his suits here as well. There was that Brioni shop just off Piazza di Spagna. The salesman there, Antonio, always treated him well, the better to take his money. But Mohammed came from a trading culture as well, and you couldn't despise a man for that. It was time for the midday meal, and the Ristorante Giovanni was as good as any Roman restaurant, and better than most. His favorite waiter recognized him and waved him to his regular table on the right side, under the canopy. "That's our boy," Jack told them, waving his glass. The three Americans watched his waiter bring a bottle of Pellegrino water to the table, along with a glass of ice. You didn't see much ice in Europe, where people thought it something to ski or skate on, but evidently 56 liked his water cold. Jack was better placed to look in his direction.
I wonder what he likes to eat.
The condemned is supposed to have a decent last meal, Dominic noted. Not that mutt in Alabama, of course. He'd probably had bad taste anyway. Then he wondered what they served for lunch in hell. His guest is supposed to show at 1:30, right?
Correct. 56 told him to be careful in his routine. That might mean to check for a tail.
Suppose he's nervous about us? Bryant wondered.
Well, Jack observed, they have had some bad luck lately.
You have to wonder what he's thinking, Dominic said.
He leaned back in his chair and stretched, catching a glance at their subject. It was a little warm to be wearing a jacket and tie, but they were supposed to look like businessmen, not tourists. Now he wondered if that was a good cover or not. You had to take temperature into account. Was he sweating because of the mission or the ambient temperature? He hadn't been overly tense in Rome, Munich, or Vienna, had he? No, not then. But this was a more crowded... No, the landscape in London had been more crowded, hadn't it?
There are good serendipities and bad ones. This time a bad one happened.
A waiter with a tray of glasses of Chianti tripped on the big feet of a woman from Chicago in Rome to check on her roots. The tray missed the table, but the glasses got both twins in the lap. Both were wearing light-colored suits to deal with the heat, and...
Oh, shit! Dominic exclaimed, his biscuit-colored Brooks Brothers trousers looking as though he'd been hit in the groin with a shotgun. Brian was in even worse shape.
The waiter was aghast.
Scusi, scusi, signori, he gasped.
But there was nothing to be done about it. He started jabbering about sending their clothes to the cleaners. Dom and Brian just looked at each other. They might as easily have borne the mark of Cain.
It's okay, Dominic said in English. He'd forgotten all of his Italian oaths. Nobody died. The napkins would not do much about this. Maybe a good dry cleaner. And the Excelsior probably had one on staff, or at least close by. A few people looked over, either in horror or amusement, and so his face was as well-marked as his clothing. When the waiter retreated in shame, the FBI agent asked,
Okay, now what?
Beats the hell out of me, Brian responded. Random chance has not acted in our favor, Captain Kirk.
Thanks a bunch, Spock, Dom snarled back.
Hey, I'm still here, remember? Jack told them both.
Junior, you can't...
But Jack cut Brian off.
Why the hell not?
He asked quietly.
How hard is it?
You're not trained, Dominic told him.
It's not playing golf at the Masters, is it?
Well, it was Brian again.
Is it?
Jack demanded. Dominic pulled his pen out of his coat pocket and handed it across.
Twist the nib and stick it in his ass, right?
It's all ready to go, Enzo confirmed, but be careful, for Christ's sake. It was 1:21 now.
Mohammed Hassan had finished his glass of water and poured another. Mahmoud would soon be here.
Why take the chance of interrupting an important meeting? He shrugged to himself and stood, walking inside for the men's room, which had pleasant memories.
You sure you want to do this? Brian asked.
He's a bad guy, isn't he? How long does this stuff take to work?
About 30 seconds, Jack. Use your head. If it doesn't feel right, back away and let him go, Dominic told him. This isn't a fucking game, man.
Right.
What the hell? Dad did this once or twice, he told himself. Just to make sure... He bumped into a waiter and asked where the men's room was. The waiter pointed and Jack went that way. It was an ordinary wooden door with a symbolic label rather than the words because of Giovanni's international clientele.
What if there's more than one guy in there? He asked himself.
Then you blow it off, dumbass.
Okay.
He walked in, and there was somebody else, drying his hands. But then he walked out, and Ryan was alone with 56 Moha,
who was just zipping up and starting to turn. Jack pulled the pen from his inside jacket pocket and turned the tip to expose the iridium syringe tip. He resisted the instinctive urge to check the tip with his finger as not a very smart move, and slid past the well-suited stranger, and then, as told, dropped his hand and got him right in the left cheek. He expected to hear the discharge of the gas, but didn't. Muhammad Hassan al-Din jumped at the sudden sharp pain and turned to see what looked like an ordinary young man. Wait. He'd seen this face at the hotel. Oh, sorry to bump into you, pal. The way he said it lit off warning lights in his consciousness. He was an American, and he'd bumped into him, and he'd felt a stick in his buttocks, and he'd killed the Jew here, and... Who are you? Jack had counted off 15 seconds or so, and he was feeling his oats. I'm the man who just killed you, 56 Moha, he replied evenly. The man's face changed into something feral and dangerous. His right hand went into his pocket and came out with a knife, and suddenly it wasn't at all funny anymore. Jack instinctively backed away with a jump. The terrorist's face was the very image of death. He opened his folding knife and locked onto Jack's throat as his target. He brought the knife up and took a half a step forward and... The knife dropped from his hand. He looked down at his hand in amazement, then looked back up. Or tried to. His head didn't move. His legs lost their strength. He fell straight down. His knees bounced painfully on the tile floor, and he fell forward, turning left as he did so. His eyes stayed open, and then he was face up, looking at the metal plate glued to the bottom of the urinal, where Green Gold had wanted to retrieve the package from before, and... Greetings from America, 56 Moha. You fucked with the wrong people. I hope you like it in hell, pal. His peripheral vision saw the shape move to the door, and the increase and decrease of light as the door opened and closed. Ryan stopped there and decided to go back. There was a knife in the guy's hand. He took the handkerchief from his pocket and removed the knife, then just slid it under the body. Better not to dick with it anymore, he thought. Better to... No, one more thing entered his mind. He reached into 56's pants pocket and found what he sought. Then he took his leave. The crazy part was that he felt a great need to urinate at the moment and walked fast to make that urge subside. In a matter of seconds, he was back at the table. That went okay, he told the twins. I guess we need to get you guys back to the hotel, eh? There's something I need to do. Come on, he commanded. Dominic left enough euros to cover the meal, with a tip. The clumsy waiter chased after them, offering to pay for laundering their clothes, but Brian waved him off with a smile, and they walked across the Piazza di Spagna. Here they took the elevator up to the church and then walked down the street toward the hotel. They were back to the Excelsior in about 8 minutes, with both twins feeling rather stupid to have red stains on their clothes. The reception clerk saw this and asked if they needed a cleaning service. Yes, could you send somebody up? Brian asked in reply. Of course, signori, in 5 minutes. The elevator, they felt, was not bugged. Well, Dominic asked. Got him. And I got this, Jack said, holding up a room key just like theirs. What's that for? He's got a computer, remember? Oh, yeah. When they got to Moha's room, they found it had already been cleaned. Jack stopped off in his room and brought his laptop and the FireWire external drive that he used. It had 10 gigabytes of empty space that he figured he could fill up. Inside his victim's room, he attached the connector cable to the port and lit up the Dell laptop Muhammad Hassan had used. There was no time for finesse. Both his pewter and the Arabs used the same operating system, and he effected a global transfer of everything off the Arab's computer into the FireWire drive. It took 6 minutes. And then he wiped everything with his handkerchief and walked out of the room, wiping the doorknob as well. He came out in time to see the valet taking Dominic's wine-stained suit. "Well?" Dominic asked. "Done. The guys at home might like to get this." He held up the FireWire to emphasize his point. "Good thinking, man. Now what?" "Now I gotta fly home, fella. Get an email off to the home office, okay?" "Roger that, Junior." Jack got himself repacked and called the concierge, who told him there was a British Airways flight at Da Vinci Airport for London with connecting service to D.C. Dulles, but he'd have to hurry. That he did, and 90 minutes later was pulling away from the jetway, sitting in seat 2A. Mahmoud was there when the police arrived. He recognized the face of his colleague as the gurney was wheeled out of the men's room, and was thunderstruck. What he didn't know was that the police had taken the knife and made a note of the bloodstains on it. This would be sent to their laboratory, which had a DNA lab whose personnel had been trained by the London Metropolitan Police, the world leaders in DNA evidence. Without anyone to report to, Mahmoud went back to his hotel and booked passage on a flight to Dubai on Emirates Airways for the following day. He had to report today's misfortune to someone, perhaps the Emir himself, whom he'd never met and knew only by his forbidding reputation. He'd seen one colleague die and watched the body of another. What horrendous misfortune was this? He'd consider this with some wine. Allah the Merciful would surely forgive him for the transgression. He'd seen too much in too little time. Jack Jr. got a mild case of the shakes on the flight to Heathrow. He needed somebody to talk to, but that would take a long time to make happen, and so he gunned down 2 miniatures of scotch before landing in England. 2 more followed in the front cabin of the 777 inbound to Dulles, but sleep would not come. He'd not only killed somebody, but had taunted him as well. Not a good thing, but neither was it something to pray to God about, was it? The FireWire drive had 3 gigabytes off 56's Dell laptop. Exactly what was on it? That he could not know for sure. He could have attached it to his own laptop and gone exploring, but no, that was a job for a real computer geek. They'd killed 4 people who had struck out at America, and now America had struck back on their turf and by their rules. The good part was that the enemy could not possibly know what kind of cat was in the jungle. They'd hardly met the teeth. Next, they'd meet the brain. This concludes the reading of The Teeth of the Tiger by Tom Clancy. Copyright 2003 by Rubicon Incorporated. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Stephen Hoy. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.